fuck you! Australia! Germany! Africa!
Here we go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, 1 minute past the hour, and this is the horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. That's where you go if you want to jump into the multimedia, real-time, wacky, zany, madcap extravaganza that is the horn chat room, where you will be greeted by Anatole and Texas T and even more as they wander by on this Thorn in the Side Thursday. You will also, of course, be capably moderated by longtime, inveterate, indefatigable chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a third stage guild navigator, but one with a high degree of good common sense, has not folded space to become man cave today. No. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is a, if you want to go to the chat room, you know, headonradionetwork.com/chatroom. Pick out a screen name, password, jump in, have fun. This is, of course, a listener-supported program. We try to raise $200 every evening to keep things going, and we actually jumped out of the hole last night. So that's awesome to know. And such being the case, well, we got $200 to raise this evening. Thank you very kindly, Jeremy in Vermont, loud and clear on TuneIn. I appreciate it. And my apologies for anybody who has problems with TuneIn. I've heard that, well, I heard from Ray in Florida last night that their transmission, that the TuneIn transmission leaves something to be desired. We just send the stream up. They pick it up. What they do with it, I don't know. But, you know, we're glad to be on there. We're glad to be on Stitcher. We're glad to have our podcast on Podbean. You know, the horn, me, Dr. Bill, Rick Smith is on Podbean, too. So, there's a jillion different ways to get the program. And you can always fall back on the direct stream links there at whiterosesociety.org, if all else fails. Oh, and there's Jules wandering into the chat room. Good evening, Jules. Let's see. Oh, yes, a listener-supported program. That's why the tab is there at headonradionetwork.com that says contribute on it. We are looking always looking for new subscribers. You know, $10 a month, set it and forget it, 20, whatever you want to do. And, you just fill out the form, click the box, move on to the next page, PayPal, credit cards, what have you. So a little something different, though. Well, a bit of an announcement, really. I was in touch with one of my dear friends up in the Northwoods a couple of nights ago. And it's that time of year up there. It's Manuman harvesting time, Manuman being an Anishinaabe word meaning good berry, which is the word for wild rice. And, you know, you can buy it in the stores, you know, commercially grown, that kind of thing. It can't touch what is the wild rice that gets harvested up in one of the most beautiful areas of the planet and one of the richest and most abundant areas of the planet for the harvesting of this. And it truly is wild. It's not cultivated. and they harvest it the same way it's been harvested for probably, you know, 10,000 years. And so there's kind of a premium on the table. And we're not selling anything. But for people who, it's going to work out this way. If you want to kick in, $60, it'll get you a pound of hand-harvested wild rice in thankful return for helping keep the horn on the air. If, however, you want 2 pounds, well, then the price drop. It's not a price, but it goes to $100 contribution will get you 2 pounds. Okay, 60 for one, 100 for two, and there's a little bit of a break in there, isn't there? Now, what I need from you in response to that, I need a good mailing address, name and a mailing address, and it'll be shipped to me, and then I'll turn it around and ship it to you. So, if you would like to participate in that, and I'm mentioning it now because it was mentioned to me, but secondarily, because things like Samhain are coming up, Thanksgiving. It is a beautiful, beautiful thing to have on your Thanksgiving Day table. And Christmas even. And back when I had a bunch of it, I had enough to, on New Year's Day a few years back, to make Hoppin' John with it. Oh, my goodness. Steve from Georgia Stan asking, is this brown or white rice, Bob? It's not rice at all. Rice is what, you know, white colonialist Europeans called it. It's a grass seed. It is a wild grass seed. But it is, for shorthand purposes, referred to as wild rice. Really nutritious, really delicious. And for those of you who don't know, you take a canoe or boat, something, well, Never mind Tony Norman, yes, Mother Bates Perkins, and whether it was a canoe or a pirogue or what, and you go into the areas, the along in the streams there, in the Northwoods of northern Wisconsin, and you don't cut it down, you gently bend the stalks over into your boat, and you tap gently between two wooden rods, poles, whatever. You don't beat it, you just tap, and it falls off into the canoe. And then you let it back up, it stands back up, and a few grains fall down into the water where they will regerminate and provide the crop for the next year. I was told when I was up there that, for instance, they'll take cooked wild rice, you know, unseasoned or anything, and put it in pancake batter. Yum. And, of course, serve over it the Pinocchi Gold maple syrup, for which the region is justifiably proud. There's all kinds of it's often served up steamed and then sautéed with onions and celery and a little bit of bacon. You can leave the bacon out for some folks. But I have access to this. And I'm darn sure getting me some. And I wanted to make it available to y'all as well. Because it's so unique. It's not something you're going to find on your grocer shelves. Like I said, you might find a package of brown rice, but it's not this, not by a long shot. You know, a lot of work goes into it. After it's been harvested, it has to be dried, and then you separate the grain from the chaff, and it's special. And you'll be participating in something that humanity has been nurturing and caring for naturally. No pesticides, no artificial fertilizers, just the manumen. And it's been going on for millennia and millennia, largely harvested in the same way. So if you want it, let me know. Shoot me an email, bobkincaid@gmail.com, and we'll get started on it. And then just go over, and whether you want 1 pound or two, depending on what, just do the thing over at the Contribute tab at headonradionetwork.com. No, Brother Deacon Asa. Asa asks, do we get to eat the wild rice as we use our vacuum cleaner to pick up a bowling ball and drop it on our Swedish mattress while waiting for the herbal Rogaine to kick in? No. Because, see, this stuff's real. Whereas the herbal hair growth tonic or the herbal stiffy capsule or the vacuum cleaner that picks up bowling balls and drops them again on Swedish, no. Because, well, that's just paid advertisement. This isn't that. This is merely an opportunity to participate in a millennia-old process and support the horn at the same time and have something absolutely delightful along the way. So, PayPal, email, and I'd say the turnaround will probably be somewhere between 2 weeks and a month. And you'll have it there in time for your fall feasting, however it is that you go about doing that. So I'll keep it on the table for a few days just to gauge people's interest. And then, you know, get the order off, that kind of thing. Because it's going to be, I'm excited. I'm really, really excited. So just let me know. And, you know, beyond that, the simple matter of fundraising for the evening, one at 200, two at 100, four at 50, eight at 25, 16 at 12.50, 32 at 6 1/4, 64 at $3.13. But we're trying to raise $200 this evening and stay out of the hole that we got out of last night. Now, it is Thorn in the Side Thursday this evening, and there's lots of opportunities. I mean, it's that kind of Thursday. You could make a compelling argument that this Thursday is more Thorn than Thursday. And so there's a lot of different directions in which we can go. But one of the ones that leaped out at me was something that Agnes provided to me. It's actually a story from a couple of months back, but it remains relevant. We will file this under How Capitalism Screws Up Everything. Now, for instance, there are many truth seekers, many loyalists. There's a lot of overlap in the Venn diagram between the Horn and the truth seekers. Hornedanistas and truth seekers. And so consequently, you probably know, for instance, that one of the wonderful sponsors that Mike has, Mike and Kathy, is Blue Tribe Coffee from down in Mexico, and I've tried it, and it's wonderful. And they offer a broad range, and it's all done fair trade, and the farmers are well compensated. Well, this is not that. This is not that. Instead, the so-called West, America, the United States, Europeans, whatever, what have you, have apparently developed a taste for something that, well, I don't have I can't drink coffee anymore because of the whole caffeine thing. But I can, but I'm really, really snobbish about my decaf. I like for it to at least taste remotely like coffee, because I remember what great coffee tasted like. And this is I don't know, this is a mug too far. Apparently the high and mighties and the hoity-toities of the fad-driven world, and not to mention the common sewers of coffee, have a passion for something, a coffee called Kopi Luwak. And according to what Agnes sent me, a single cup of Kopi Luwak can go for $80 in various coffee shops of the United States of Merca, the greatest country in the history of the world, now, today, forever, on earth, in the universe. Amen. Hallelujah. And, well, not to put too fine a point on it or ruin anybody's dinner, but Kopi Luwak is poop coffee. No, really. There's a little animal in Southeast Asia, in Sub-Saharan Africa, called a civet. C-I-V-E-T. I'm sure you've heard about this before. It's a cat-like animal. And its job in the grand scheme of the circle of life is to eat little reptiles, eat little insects, and occasionally they'll munch on a mango. And they also like to eat fresh, raw coffee berries. They're referred to as cherries. Because the coffee bean is actually the seed inside the berry. We don't do anything. It's stripped away. Well, the civets like the outside of the fruit. It's a fruit. And so the coffee bean passes through their digestive tract, and they kick it out the other end in their feces. Now, from an anthropological standpoint, a cultural or a sociological aspect, you can't help asking yourself the question, I wonder who the first human being was who looked at a pile of civet poo and thought, you know what, I'm going to make a cup of coffee out of that. Because, you know, back at the hut, we're fresh out of chasing sandborns. Maybe it was the first way coffee was ever actually consumed. It's a possibility. But for a very long time, it was harvested, if that's the word, scooped, by, well, hand, by indigenous peoples living in Sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. I guess it pretty obviously looks like a sort of fecal mass of coffee beans. And then white folks discovered it, and my goodness gracious, this is some excellent poop coffee. And so it became a thing, and it got a name. Again, the name is Kopi Luwak. And if it's $80 a cup, my God, how much is it a pound? But you can almost understand the pricing of it, because it's got to be harvested off the forest floor or wherever the hell it is that civets, go. civet's got a long tail like a monkey. It's got little stripes across its face like a raccoon. And either stripes or spots on its body. It's not an unpleasant looking creature. It's kind of cute, really. Looks kind of like a cat.
Meow.
Meow. Hi, Agnes.
Hi, Bob.
And they do participate in the circle of life because they eat the little insects, they eat the little reptiles, they eat the occasional mango, and they eat and poop out the coffee beans. And apparently, they make a lovely snack for things like leopards and big snakes and, well, crocodiles. But remember, the title of this segment is How Capitalism Screws Everything Up. Originally, it was great for the indigenous people who would go and, you know, sell the poop coffee to the suckers. I mean, wealthy Westerners. People claim that passing through the digestive tract of a civet makes the coffee less acidic and smoother. Funny, I always just put a little milk in mine and it cuts the ass. Never mind. But as with anything that becomes popular, capitalism steps in to take a hand in the matter, and the next thing you know, everything's going to hell. So now, where once the civet roamed in its cat-like way through the forests of sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia and the island groups, and, well, now, because people, hey, look, there's money in that there shit. They've taken to taking civets captive. Indonesia, in particular, has become quite popular as a tourist destination for people who want to see the little animal that shits coffee, huh? And so civets have been captured, trapped, and they're kept in cages, and they're fed nothing but coffee beans. No more small insects, no more small reptiles, and no more snacks for leopards, or big snakes, or crocodiles. And so tourists now, with more dollars than cents, Muriel, what do you say we go over to that civet cat farm and maybe watch them shit out some coffee? Wouldn't that just blow their minds back in Bug Tussle? And so the civets are just miserable now, and it's a wreck. The Oxford University Wildlife Conservation Research Unit and the World Animal Protection nonprofit out of London surveyed and assessed living conditions of 50 wild civets, because they don't really domesticate well, held at 16 plantations on Bali. It's a disaster. Every plantation that the researchers went to flunked anything resembling a requirement for basic, essential animal welfare. In some cases, the civets are kept in little containment units no bigger than a rabbit hutch. And they reek of civet urine, which one gets the idea smells no better than the cat variety. And, you know, they just poop wherever. And what's more, because they only get coffee cherries, they get malnourished. And they live on a wire mesh floor so that the incredibly valuable to capitalism, what was the name of this stuff again? Kopi Luwak will fall through the wires, where it can be harvested without having to really interact with the civets. In addition, they need clean water and don't have it. And they live lives of isolation from other civets. Meanwhile, there are the tourists. And,
look, hey, poke the cage.
They're nocturnal animals, and they're forced to do their civeting thing in broad daylight because, you know, the tourists don't want to show up at 3 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, there's no way to get free-range Kopi Luwak. There's no certification. And there's no organization to make sure it's environmentally sound or no. One sustainable coffee certification standard called UTZ, UTZ, refuses to certify any Kopi Luwak coffee. Rainforest Alliance won't touch it. So, you know, just one of the... Oh, I'm sure we need to be talking about Donald Trump, don't we? I'm sorry. But I saw that and I just couldn't... I kind of went, wow. Because it is as if capitalism and wealth makes people disembody from their own existence. Oh, Muffy, you must have a cup of this poop coffee. It's magnificent. Oh, who gives a damn what happened to those little creatures? I'm sure they fuck like rabbits. And I got a sneaking suspicion that there's not a whole bunch of members of the Horn Family Community Congregation that are running around buying $80 cups of coffee. But still, if you offer to taste, no, I'll pass, thanks. Just take me to the, get me some of that Blue Tribe stuff. At least I've, well, not at least. With that, I know what I'm getting and where it's coming from and that nobody's living on, in cages on wire mesh floors and having to through a screen. Really, people. Sheesh. Marty says, $80 for a cup of Joe? Oh, that's right. I remember that coffee now. No thanks. I'll stick with my Café du Monde. Good stuff, that Café du Monde. The coffee is strong at the Café du Monde. The donuts are too hot to touch, but just like a fool when those sweet goodies cool. I eat till I eat way too much. But I'm living on things that excite me, either pastry or lobsters or love. Never mind. Lyrics, they get stuck in my head. I'm sorry. So it just as a thorn in the side, that. Because really, capitalism ruins everything. Why couldn't the people who originally discovered and drank poop coffee go on drinking their poop coffee and be left in peace? No, by God, there's a dollar to be made. Damn, put those damned animals in a cage. Eat that damn coffee. You're not going to get anything else to eat. You might as well eat it. I mean, talk about it. There's an old analogy out there involving dogs and peach pits. I feel for the little animals, the little civets. But most of us, most the just about the entirety of life on Earth has been reduced to a disembodied experience in service of capitalism. I was, as I've mentioned, most evenings I have to go after the program and pick up Ferg at work. Now, what do I do when I'm doing that? I fire up TuneIn and I listen to Malloy as I make the 2-hour round trip drive. And so it was that Tuesday night, as I was driving along, I heard Malloy talking about this article, the opinion piece written by Bill McKibben and published on August the 15th over at New Republic. And everything that Bill McKibben writes, and, you know, I've met him, I know him, we've communicated, I respect his work immensely. Everything that Bill McKibben writes has the aspect of a desperate call to action. And the latest article is no different. And Mike read from it extensively. Bill McKibben is working a metaphor here, and he does it with tremendous talent. In the North this summer, a devastating offensive is underway. Oh, wait, I think we need to... Dang it, where's Barbie? In the North this summer, a devastating offensive is underway. Enemy forces have seized huge swaths of territory. With each passing week, another 22,000 square miles of Arctic ice disappears. Experts dispatched to the battlefield in July saw little cause for hope, especially since this siege is one of the oldest fronts in the war. In 30 years, the area has shrunk approximately by half, said a scientist who examined the onslaught. There doesn't seem anything able to stop this. He goes on to talk about what the enemy has done in the Pacific. Saboteurs, what they've done. Firestorms. Floods. Refugees. And of course, he's talking about the effects of global climate catastrophe. World War III is well and truly underway, and we are losing. Now, with the Cronkite voice, I'm not making fun of what Bill McKibben writes. I'm in complete agreement with it. He's absolutely right. But I was so taken by what Mike shared that I went and I read the article myself, which I'm sure many of you did as well. And it made an impact on me. And it left me feeling, how can I put this? Not encouraged. And again, since we started the program with how capitalism screws everything up, by all means, let's continue to work with the theme. Because there's no greater example of how capitalism screws everything up than the global climate catastrophe. You know, what do you mean we need to stop using hydrocarbons? God damn it, do you realize how much money we make? Well, I mean, sure, we're going to kill the planet. Well, we're not going to kill the planet. The planet's going to be fine, but Are we going to make it almost impossible for human beings to continue on as a species? Well, yes, but we will, some of us, a very few of us, the ones that matter, will die extremely rich. And this, of course, is damned well what matters. That a few people get extremely rich. They may run ads on television about how the fossil fuel fracking industry provides many, many good-paying jobs. They don't give a damn about the jobs, and when the day comes that they can do it all with robots, there won't be any jobs. Well, we'll have many jobs building robots. Not after the robots learn to build the robots, they won't. Never mind. That's a different topic. But as I sat there listening to Mike read from the article, I was kind of overwhelmed with the sense of, well, if this is a war, I think we've already signed the terms of surrender. And in fact, it was unconditional. Because we have. Most of the plans for addressing climate change are couched in terms of doing something by 2030 or doing something by 2050. Or, you know, hopefully before the water, the sea is over the shoe tops of a whole bunch of people all over the planet in, you know, 2100 tops. Very few people talk about the fact that if we were going to do anything, the things we needed to have been done back in the 1970s, you know, when I was a kid. But nonetheless, Bill McKibben talks about the act of national will, the act of global will, that will be required to stop this. Absolute things, like ending the use of hydrocarbons as fuel. And I got to thinking about, in conjunction, I don't know if you saw it, I didn't, it was on CNN last night, the Greens got a chance to put forward their vision of the world, and it includes things like ending the use of hydrocarbons now, with which I agree, in principle. But as I heard Mike and as I reread the article, I started thinking about that, what that would mean in practical terms. I mean, in terms of things like economic chaos.
Jesus. I don't know what people are going to do when a six-pack of Budweiser costs $1,200.
Oh, they'll be off?
Yeah.
You've got a collapse of confidence in the currency. People are going to panic.
Yeah.
There's going to be gold riots, atonal music, right. Political chaos, right. Mass suicide, right?
Yeah.
It's Germany before Hitler. Uh-huh. You can see that.
Yeah. Now, 6:39, by the way. Who had 6:39? 6:39 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Remember, All wagers must be expressed in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone. But something, and that's probably what motivates the political class who says, well, you know, we'll slowly phase into stopping committing species side by 2050. That's what we'll do, definitely. We'll definitely do that. By which time, most of the scientists who are not alarmists, who have offered up their scenarios and their models under the most conservative estimates. But while we stand around with our thumbs up our butts for another 30 years, we're going to be hearing the game over noise. So if we're going to use Bill McKibben's war analogy, I think we kind of have to say that the significant portions of the developed world, okay, the United States, is probably a plurality, if not a majority, of the United States are yelling, hell no, we won't go. And a problem, and if this is a critique, it is a very, very gentle one, for again, I have such profound respect for Bill McKibben. If there is a critique, it is that we've got to figure out a way to deal with this without resorting to the favorite tactic of the right wing, namely eliminationism. We've got to figure out a way to deal with the problem without talking in terms that require eliminationist rhetoric. And describing anything, whether it be on poverty or on drugs or on halitosis as a war, plays into that. Because the problem with calling anything a war except war is that war requires an enemy. And as noted, the article begins with a reference to war and battlefield and a breakout. And an assault. Saboteurs. Attacks. Firestorms. Several paragraphs in, Bill McKibben says, we're used to war as a metaphor. The war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on cancer. Usually this is just a rhetorical device. A way of saying we need to focus our attention and marshal our forces to fix something we don't like. But then he says this. But this is no metaphor. By most of the ways we measure war's climate change is the real deal. If it's the real deal, then, if it is a real war, then there is a real enemy. And the real enemy has real faces. Because they're real people. And if we have learned anything from the blood-sodden 20th century is that no one gets to opt out of a real global war. Think of the civilian victims of the Rape of Nanking. Think of the very real civilian victims of the firebombing of Dresden and of Tokyo. And of the very real civilian victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Think of the countless tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of refugees displaced by that war. If, as Bill McKibben says, this is the real deal, then we have to figure out, we have to come to terms with, we have to understand just who that enemy is. And if you drill down very far at all into it, the answer is well past disturbing. And moving quickly on to existentially horrifying. Because see, the enemy in the war that is global climate change isn't some indigenous person in the jungles of Indonesia keeping a weather eye out for little strings of civet poo. It's not someone whose ancestors for the last 30,000 years have been living on an island group that isn't going to be there anymore because the seas, the oceans are overtaking it because they are rising inexorably, regardless of what pissants like Governor Rick Scott of Florida say about the no-no of referring to Ise Ebele Isre. Or the legislature of North Carolina, or goddamn Virginia Stan. The enemy is not a subsistence is not a subsistence farmer, or one of the last remaining groups of hunter gatherers on the Kalahari. The enemy isn't a maize farmer, what's left of them, planting and harvesting as they have for the last 10,000 years in Central America. The enemy is not that person, those people. The enemy. Is us. We're it. Long time ago, the genius illustrator, writer, Walt Kelly, had his brilliant, delightful, hilarious, and often all too human character, Pogo, declare, "We have seen the enemy, and he is us." Truer words have never been spoken than to quote that in relation to climate change. At least give credit where credit is due. Germany, on a comparable latitude with Alaska, is working hammer and tongs to reduce its carbon footprint. Scotland has already closed its last coal-fired power plant, and the UK is funding and supporting and approving massive wind farms in the North Sea that I'm sure piss off Donald Trump. Because, you know, we always got to talk about Donald Trump. China put a moratorium on their own domestic coal production. And for all, based on something I recall reading, are producing an order of magnitude higher number of wind turbines than we do for every single wind turbine we put up in the United States. Solar panels are not fantasies in other parts of the world. They are rather a rational response to a looming crisis. What about us? Well, hell, the good, godly, upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing Christian people of Oklahoma keep sending a guy back to the Senate who carries snowballs into that august body in January to prove that global climate catastrophe is a monstrous hoax perpetrated upon the good people of Merca. If this is a war, and Bill McKibben says that this is no metaphor, that this is the real deal, what do you do when you look up and you realize we're the bad guys? Oh, no, we're not goose-stepping down broad avenues or anything. But we are, by God, sure as God made little green apples and they'll give you the runs and a bellyache if you eat too many sitting up in the tree. We're the bad guys. And for all the good intentions, because the little conversations that we have on any given night are, to a certain extent, a matter of a conversation between members of the choir. We're not the bad guys. Most every one of us, given the opportunity, and some of us have taken the opportunity because we had it, but most every one of us, given the opportunity, would be thrilled to power our homes and even our conveyances on sustainable green energy, and to opt out and to step away from the status of being the enemy. But as a country, we're not. And it takes a great deal more than simply saying we've got to stop using hydrocarbons now. There has to be a way forward. Because if you just turn off the spigot, yeah, atonal music. Because it would amount to an existential threat to the lives of ordinary Americans. Not the shareholders in ExxonMobil or Royal Dutch Shell or any of that silly business. Silly, brutal, bloodthirsty business. Conscienceless, sociopathic, psychopathic business. And then there's this. Even if we managed to elect a president who said this crisis is as bad as we think it is, and we've got to follow Dr. McKibben's advice, we've got to acknowledge that it is the real deal, it really is a war. And we've got to start now, and we can't stop until the problem is solved. We have a governmental structure that makes almost certain that we cannot solve the problem. We have a governmental structure that was formulated in a time when it took days to get from New York to Boston. or New York to Philadelphia, and weeks to get from Philadelphia to, say, Western Virginia, and months to go the entire longitudinal length of the young nation, and over a month to get something as simple as a note across the Atlantic. So the structure that they came up with was a structure that was grounded in their times. There were no electronic communications, so things like freedom of speech were not constrained by the immediacy of the effects that we have now. No crisis could form that could not be dealt with, even under the worst of circumstances, by a mobilization that might take months, perhaps even a year. We're done with all that. And what's more, even assuming that that governmental structure was up to the task, beginning in 1947 and culminating in, I think, 1951, we made sure that we would never have a chief executive in office who would have the time necessary to solve a great existential crisis. I'm talking about the 22nd Amendment. A pissed off and bitter Republican Congress in 1947 passed what would become the 22nd Amendment, and by 1951 it had been ratified by a sufficient number of states that it became a part of the Constitution of the United States. And thus we threw ourselves into the cycle in which we now find ourselves, in which a first-term president spends the first 4 years trying to get elected for the second 4 years, and then spends the second 4 years realizing that there's not going to be another 4 years. God only knows what the Great Depression would have done to the United States of America had Franklin Delano Roosevelt not run again, and run again after that, and then one more time. I submit that if, as McKibben suggests, this is the real deal, a real live war, then maybe one of the first things we should work on, and I know it seems ancillary, but I think it is actually critical. One of the first things we should work on is the repeal of the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Can you imagine having a president? No, I'm not talking about the devil. I'm talking about a president who would make Bill McKibben the Secretary of Energy, and who every day thought as his or her first thought, how are we going to combat climate change? How will we prevent people from starving as we scale back from a hydrocarbon-based economy? What if we had that president? Well, that president would know that he or she was limited to 8 years and that it could all be undone at the stroke of a pen at the beginning of year 9. That's a recipe for failure. Absolutely. And I'm willing, I don't know about you, but I'm willing to roll the dice on this one. I'll take my chances that that we might wind up with a 3 or 4 term Republican nightmare. On the outside chance that we, not even outside chance, considering the way the country is changing, that we might finally wind up with a president brilliant enough and committed enough to save us from ourselves. A president committed enough to take the necessary actions to keep the entire rest of the world from finally looking at us and saying, listen, these people have got to be taken in hand. They've got to be subjugated in order to keep them from killing the rest of us, because that is what we are doing. The United States of America, by denying the crisis-level realities of climate change, is already at war with the entire rest of the world. But we got a lot of nuclear weapons, don't we? So nobody's necessarily going to take a pot shot at us. Because we might shoot back really big. You know, if we can't ruin the world one way, by God, we'll ruin humanity another. If you go to New Republic and you read this article, it'll probably do the same thing to you that it did to me. Keep you up night. All night. Because it's one thing to drop a dollar on a Powerball ticket where the odds are 129 million to one. It's entirely another to willingly live in a system in which those are the odds against the survival of humanity itself. And I'm sorry, but I'm decidedly pro-human. Hopelessly pro-human. And I don't want to, I don't want to think that it's likely. That our present condition on this planet, not individually, because it always is, but as a species, is terminal. A president who can run for a third term can wait out a bad Congress or can help build one that will help him get or her get the job done. As we've seen with both Bill Clinton, the best Republican president we've ever had, and Barack Obama, sometimes in the scope of 8 years of public service, there's no waiting them out. So I just felt like I kind of had to kind of had to, because like I said, I came home and I read it and it kept me up all night. Yeah, this isn't a scary movie where eventually your rational mind takes over and you say, yeah, well, but I mean, there's no swamp thing under the bed. No pod. This is reality. Bill McKibben does a really, really good job of trying to look at all this in a historical context. And it's not completely an exercise in grim nihilism. He says if we move quickly enough to meet the goal of 80% clean power by 2030, then the world's carbon dioxide levels would fall below the relative safety of 350 parts per million by the end of the century. The planet would stop heating up, or at least the pace of that heating would slow substantially. That's as close to winning this war as we could possibly get. We'd endure lots of damage in the meantime, but not the civilization-scale destruction we now currently face. He adds, even if all the world's nations meet the pledges they made in the Paris Accord, carbon dioxide is currently on a path to hit 500 or 600 parts per million by century's end, a path, if not to hell, then to some place with a similar setting on the thermostat. A little bit of wry college professor humor there on the part of Dr. McKibben. But drilling deeper into the whole thing, and this is what Bill McKibben doesn't do, because I think this is actually the most terrifying part of the entire inquiry. He doesn't talk about what we'll need in terms of social and governmental structure in order to accomplish it. A lot of rights went on the chopping block during the Second World War in the United States. Horrible, horrible human rights violations took place inside the United States. Think about the internment of Japanese Americans, for starters. Then think about the human rights of the innocent civilians that we relentlessly and remorselessly killed. And that's just us. Never mind Papa Joe Stalin and, you know, him. If we don't address governmental structural failings, we lose bigger than we can imagine. And if we think for a minute that capitalism is going to be any part of the solution instead of an extension of the problem, well, that way lies species side as well. And there are aspects to what I was thinking the other night that I can't and won't speak into this microphone. How one identifies and deals with an enemy when one is well past 100% certain the enemy they are. And remember, if we ditch the 22nd Amendment, that does not say that there are no more elections. That just means that a person has the right and ability to pursue more than two terms in the presidency. And then there's still the Congress to be dealt with. So, I don't know. The phone lines are open, 304-663-4676, 304-663-HORN. 304-574-8178 is the other number. From anywhere on the planet, Bob Kincaid Horn is how you reach me by Skype. And I welcome your thoughts on the topic. The two-term presidency was not ever written into or even informally adopted as law or policy of the United States. George Washington made clear that the reason he didn't pursue a third term was that he felt just too old, too tired, and too sick. Jefferson and Madison mumbled about two terms being enough. Jackson said the same. But Ulysses Grant was more than happy to go after a third term, and he got turned down by his own party. Woodrow Wilson deliberately deadlocked the Democratic Party trying to get a third term. But the party said no thank you because he had become vastly unpopular. And there are all kinds of conversations that swirl around this, money in politics, Citizens United. And you also always have to contend with the other side. When I think about what would be necessary to eliminate the use of hydrocarbons in everyday life, it runs from the micro to the macro in a real hurry. During the Second World War, which, you know, McKibben's talking about a war, and that's the best example of a massive national globalization that we have. You know, there were things like rationing laws. And even during the Second World War, we had libertarians. Not nearly as noisy or as obsessed with smoking dope as they are now. Not that smoking dope's a bad thing. But I have never forgotten reading that profile piece. I think it was in the New York Times about cranky old Ron Paul. Cranky old Ron Paul was a kid growing up in Pittsburgh during the Second World War. And he repeatedly told the story, and it was repeated in the New York Times profile of him, about one of his heroes in the Second World War. Was it General Patton? No. General MacArthur? Uh-uh. Audie Murphy? Nope. FDR? Nope. Way. Little Ron Paul's hero during the Second World War was a butcher in Pittsburgh who deliberately flouted the meat rationing laws and sold beef onto the black market to the highest bidder. Because free market. Because capitalism. Because freedom. No way to figure out if a particular soldier or sailor went hungry or missed a meal because of however many pounds that no good piece of shit butcher in Pittsburgh withheld. But that attitude that had the butcher been found out probably would have wound up getting him ridden out of town on a rail with tar and feathers all over him. That attitude is now one of the prevailing political forces in the United States. Uh-huh. That's how we wound up having a nasty little illegal war in Iraq, in which a Halliburger went for $29. And military suppliers, Halliburton among them, were found to be maintaining mess halls for a profit, where the troops were fed rotten chow. And so that is another hurdle we have to leap. So go and, you know, go and read the article. And, or if there's something that's got you thinking already, ring up the phones. Jim said a couple of minutes ago, two terms. Remember the Enabling Act passed by the Reichstag in 1933? More than just a roll of the dice. Not really. This is not them. This is not them. We are not them. And we were rolling the dice from the moment that George Washington took office, if it was a roll of the dice, or more than. Jim says Wilson was too sick, and the rumor is that his wife was the virtual president. Regardless, Wilson wanted a third term. And he did deadlock the Democratic convention, trying to get one. And he died in the new year. But he wanted a third term. Reagan wanted a third term. And you know what? Given the choice between the two, I would run to the polls to give Barack Obama a third term over, you know, the devil! So there's that. Okay, then, that's enough filibuster. Remember, we try to raise $200 every evening to keep the program on the air, and we hope to stay out of a hole, and there's a premium. There's a premium available out there if you want to avail yourself of it. And you'll enjoy the heck out of it in the process. So, break time. It being a Thursday, this Thorn in the Side Thursday, the 18th of August, 2016, we've got the Green News Report coming up. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Life, keep me breathing.
It's Thursday, August 18, 2016.
And in my 40 years of fighting fire, I've never seen fire behavior so extreme as it was yesterday.
Another new wildfire forces evacuations for 80,000 in Southern California.
Every mile that we gain in fuel efficiency is worth thousands of dollars of savings every year.
The Obama administration issues new rules for heavy-duty trucks. New report finds eliminating fossil fuel subsidies won't raise gas prices. Plus, America gets its first ever offshore wind farm.
First ever?
Yep.
Really?
Yeah.
We suck. All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Every time somebody says you can't grow the economy while bringing down pollution, it's turned out they've been wrong.
Yes, maybe. But that's only if you believe in facts, Mr. President. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, California is beginning to pay a very, very high price for climate change, as these fires out here are just getting insane, and we haven't even gotten to the peak of wildfire season yet.
Yep. Governor Jerry Brown has issued another state of emergency due to wildfire in California, this time in Southern California, where more than 80,000 people have quickly evacuated to escape a new fast-moving wildfire that exploded in size overnight this week in the mountains east of Los Angeles. In less than a day, the Blue Cut fire expanded to 47 square miles with an intensity that state fire official Glenn Barley called unprecedented.
This is a challenging year. One of the things that we're seeing is that the fires are burning in a really unprecedented fashion. It's to the point where explosive fire growth is the new normal this year, and that's a challenge for all of us to take on.
Driven by high winds, extreme high temperatures, and tinderbox conditions, the Blue Cut fire has already destroyed entire neighborhoods and shut down Interstate 15, the critical highway, railroad, and energy infrastructure corridor between Southern California and Las Vegas. And it's not just the U.S. In Brazil, Brazil's National Space Research Institute on Friday reported that fires in the Amazon have increased 65% over the same period last year. They theorize that the jump in the sheer number of fires is due to humans using slash-and-burn techniques to clear the forest for farms amid unusually hot and dry weather. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has confirmed NASA's report from a few days ago that July 2016 was the hottest month ever recorded in human history. And they added that July was also the 15th straight month in a row to break the monthly temperature record.
Wow. This is just getting insane. I'm sure the people have stopped contacting you on Twitter claiming that climate change is a hoax, right?
Oh, don't be silly.
Oh.
Some good news, though. The Obama administration this week issued its final new fuel efficiency rules, this time for heavy trucks, that will cut emissions 25% over the next 10 years and save nearly $200 billion in fuel costs. In announcing the draft version of the rules last year, President Obama called the new standards a big win.
And improving gas mileage for these trucks, that reduces carbon pollution even more, cuts down on businesses' fuel costs, which should pay off in lower prices for consumers. So it's not just a win-win, it's a win-win-win. You got three wins.
Heavy trucks, buses, vans, and tractor trailers account for only 4% of vehicle traffic, but 20% of fuel use and transportation emissions in the U.S.
You can take my expensive, stupid, heavy-duty truck fuel efficiency when you pry it from my cold Oh, never mind.
Meanwhile, a new report from economic researchers at Tufts University finds that three major federal subsidies for oil and gas drillers, amounting to billions of dollars in taxpayer funding each year, could be eliminated without raising gas prices very much, adding at most maybe 2 cents to the price of a gallon of gas by 2030.
2 cents
for each gallon by 2030?
Yes.
Okay, let's keep giving away those taxpayer dollars to the most profitable industry in the history of mankind.
Finally, the U.S. has an offshore wind farm.
What?
The United States is late to the game after Europe's wildly successful offshore wind farms have been generating billions of dollars worth of clean energy for two decades. But this week, the U.S. finally installed its first ever offshore wind turbine. The first in a small wind installation off the coast of Rhode Island. So, hey, that's one.
Meanwhile, just last weekend, we drove past dozens and dozens of offshore oil platforms. I guess no problem with that and all the oil that it constantly leaks on the beaches. But, you know, wind, that's a bridge too far. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to, please blow by our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us, follow us, and harass us on the Twitters and the Facebook. Well, harass Desi at Green News Report. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Against the wind. We were running against the wind. We were young and strong.
Little correction. 27 minutes past the hour. Little correction. You may have heard about the, you were listening to the Green News Report there. I love it. And you heard the reference to the EPA's efficiency standards for heavy-duty trucks. You then heard Brad Friedman say, you can have my stupid heavy-duty truck when you pry it from my cold, dead fingers. Well, this is a problem caused by government terminology. For instance, trucks built Ford Tough. The heavy-duty Ford F-150. Built Ram Tough. The heavy-duty Ram 2500. Mm-mm, no. That's all advertising. Anything that's a consumer-bought truck is a light-duty truck. I don't care if it's what used to be called a one-ton or a three-quarter ton or a half-ton. Those are all technically light-duty. Duty trucks. The heavy-duty trucks contemplated under the new EPA rule are what you and I usually call things like tractor trailers. Those kinds of trucks. Great big sons of bitches. So when we say heavy-duty truck, we don't mean the kind of thing that some asshole coal roller modifies to make it pump out more diesel smoke, which it sounds like was what Brad was thinking about, but that's not the case, if I understand. No, not at all. Okay, let's run over, and I always enjoy our conversations. Let's run over and check in with Snork on the issue of climate change. Hey, Snork.
Oh. There are a lot of technologies out there that just do not get the publicity they need that would just take away the need for any kind of fossil fuels or mined materials. And one of them comes to my mind is I had a project about 10 years ago where I had two pieces of metal that needed to rub across each other at a high Mach speed. And normal oils are just full of junk, grit. And what doesn't seem like grit at 5,000 RPMs might seem like grit at a much higher rate. And we had to actually grow. We had the University of Northern Iowa grow us a rapeseed that's related to canola oil.
Well, I mean, canola is rapeseed.
Yeah, and they distilled it for us and made an oil that we had to have tests run. We had another university take their oil and compare it to standard like jet oil for high-speed turbines. And it lasted 1,000 times longer. After 3 weeks at whatever RPM they ran it at, the pin actually was worn through that they were testing a piece of steel, and hardly showed anywhere. So there are almost every oil out there that we need that can be fractioned off from a petroleum that we mine, not only can be produced without mining, it can be produced better. And there just is no reason for it. The next thing is we do not use the sun enough. We barely are starting to get the idea that we can use it for making electricity. And out in the desert, we have a few reflector projects where they reflect the sun to a common point and
yes,
heat it up.
Solar furnaces. Is that what?
Right. Now, that's being used to heat salt, and they gradually take the heat off all day long and all night, and even in cloudy weather. It doesn't have to be just heating to make electricity. You can be heating to process all types of material, to recapture old concrete. We don't need to dig up new limestone. We can take the old concrete that's out there everywhere. You take it down to anywhere that's sunny. Even the southeast states have enough sun to do this. Heat it to 3,000 degrees with the sun, and you've got it back to being cement, Portland cement, that you can use to mix with water again and let it go through the cycle. It doesn't have to be remined. And it's the mining that takes so much more energy than we even think. You know, we think of the 1 pound of concrete that we drive over, and we think of the fuel that is used to drive, and we don't think of the fuel used to make the road or the tire. All of these things can be done using stored heat. I realize sometimes in a manufacturing operation you're going to want to use electricity or something to reheat something. But there are so many applications that were done in the north with coal that could be done in the south with sun that we're not thinking about everything we do of how are we wasting our opportunities to not burn stuff. How are we not wasting our opportunities to get anything done with another energy source that doesn't have to go through storage and conversion?
What about there's no CO2 issues with say a solar focused or solar furnace sort of installation you're describing?
We really haven't gotten to the next issue after carbon dioxide yet. We say global warming. What we have is a lack of cold, which is much worse because we can only use energy when we're going between two states. So if you have a ball laying on the floor and the floor is flat, it doesn't roll. And the same is true in any energy form that you make. Until that floor is tilting, that ball is not going to roll. Until we give the energy to raise one side of the floor and make it a ramp, then the ball rolls. We have the same problems with electricity generation. That's why we need the heat to make the electricity. We basically need to keep pumping that energy in from the one side to get the power out. And it's even true with electricity. On the solar cells, the one where the bluish ones that you see that are photoelectric, the sun actually knocks an electron down the pipeline for that. Call it a pipeline, sorry.
I'd rather have that pipeline than, you know, the one like they're fighting in North Dakota.
Yeah, when you heat up concrete, it gives off carbon dioxide. But as soon as you stop heating it and you open it back up to air, it starts sucking it back. So it's really a no-gain situation because nobody's going to make concrete unless you're going to, or Portland cement, unless they're going to use it to make concrete. And you're going to just keep trading back the same carbon over and over. but you're not going to use all that carbon to take the great big trucks and the excavators out to dig up the limestone.
True, true. And, you know, the externalities of any form of mining make bad matters worse.
Anytime you wound the earth.
Exactly, because anytime you open the earth remembers, and the earth will tell later. You know, all the way down to plow scars in dirt. You can see them 200 years later. So, yeah. That's very well, that's very 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 much true. The question though is that science does not yet have all the answers, and I don't think you would suggest that they do.
No, but a lot of them are out there that just aren't being used, and it is so hard for anybody to get their ideas out there when immediately they're slapped on the wall. There's no global warming.
Well, that for one, Snork, but for two, capitalism. Nothing is going to be deployed that cannot be deployed to the best interests of 0.1% of the people in this country and on this planet.
Our current interpretation is that government is there, that once they figure out something that can be an income source for somebody, that it gets sold off to an individual and no longer done by a government function. Franklin's original vision was that any time that it couldn't be fairly distributed amongst the people, that it be a government function. And I think that's kind of the case with power, that we do need to have some national power policies. I don't think the electricity should be, you know, at least on the grid, once it's a utility, it should be publicly owned.
Well, my personal feeling, Snork, is that there are a number of aspects of our day-to-day lives that should not be subject to the profit motive.
Ambulances.
Basically, basic utilities, medical care, clean water, clean air. You shouldn't just because somebody happens to live in southern West Virginia doesn't mean that say Alpha Natural Resources should have the right to poison the air that they breathe. Those things need to not only be not subject to profit, but they need to come first.
Yeah,
I guess that would probably qualify me as some sort of bomb throwing, you know, Trotskyite or something in the eyes of Republicans and whatnot. But I'm sorry, I just don't think that somebody getting sick should be cause for celebration on Wall Street.
Well, that's pretty much what I thought about. Even disposing of garbage, I don't think can be handled on an individual basis, because it becomes for profit, and we're not thinking about what the best way. Using sunlight, you can make a plasma that basically evaporates any type of plastic. Plastic is carbons, oxygens, and hydrogens. It goes to nothing. Just vaporizes. Of course, you want to recapture the CO2 part of it, but we're not giving any money to deal with our how we do it. And I think what the public needs to learn is some tools from how a manufacturing failure is. If I went into like a GM plant that was in failure, I would be looking at. If somebody says that, you know, the steering wheel is not working, I say, well, why isn't the steel wheel working? And they'll say, the nut's falling off. And the next question is, why is the nut falling off? And it get tight enough. So you'd go through who tightened it, what are the tightening procedures, how do you make sure he tightened it right, how do you make sure that the tools that he tested that were working right. And we would go 8 levels deep so that when we walked out of that plant, that problem didn't occur again. Or at least until some other supervisor decided they need to save 5 cents and change a procedure, which is usually what happens when there's a car recall.
Well, as Stockton Larry points out in the chat room, if it can't be monetized as a rule, it ain't going to happen around here. Mm-hmm. And you know those are the little Those are the little wooden shoes among the cogs that point toward not actually being able to solve this problem. Because we haven't figured out a way to make the 0.1% in this country like it and be happy about it and get richer from it, which circles back around to what do you do when you've defined to 110% certainty satisfaction who the enemy is? What do you do? Don't answer that.
Well, we are the enemy.
Well, I mean, no, you're not Snork. I'm not. Workaday America generally isn't. I mean, if you gave everyday America the chance and you said, listen, you can have solar panels and no power bill, or you can have a power bill and keep heating up the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even if they're deniers, they're going to say, well, I want the no power bill. That's what I want, no power bill. But, of course, that's bad for the billionaires and trillionaires who own our antiquated coal-fired, gas-fired, decentralized electrical grid. Now, if the government, if it was something that was owned by we the people, we could move toward grid 2.0 or 5.0 or whatever we're calling it, and it wouldn't, you know, it would not be impacted by the howls of Wall Street. I mean, that seems to be in the way of the essence of the problem. But you're right, the technologies are out there. We as people, like I said, I don't think we're deliberately the problem. The deliberate problem is created by 0.1% of the people in this country and on this planet. But yeah, because of the economy that they foist upon us and compel us to participate in, we become accessories to the problem. I mean, you talk about garbage. We don't need to generate as much garbage as we generate. We do not have to have a patch of garbage in the middle of the Pacific Ocean the size of Texas. We don't have to have that. It's not a cost of doing business to have, you know, 7 billion, 6 billion people on the planet, and that you just have to have that. So, I mean, there are ways to, you know, reduce, reuse, recycle, but we have to, in this system, 0.1% of the population of this country has to want them, never mind the rest of us. I mean, does that make sense?
Sure does. And a lot of them make profit by inducing wants in us through advertisements. Oh, my car's bigger, powerful. You know, when I was growing up, cars were immensely powerful for, you know, people that needed to drive a moderate speed. Everybody had a 350 cubic inch engine. It was a standard issue almost in any four-door car, 350 or better.
I grew up in that same era. We're roughly the same age. I remember a certain Dodge Monaco Brome station wagon with a 440 Magnum 4-barrel under the hood.
Mm-hmm. And the car in commercials always included, they didn't include mile per gallon until the mid-70s or late 70s. But they did include 0-60.
Oh, yeah, and you know, and BHP.
Mm-hmm.
One of the benefits of, and you know, it's relative because we're still burning hydrocarbons, is that you can get as much power out of a smaller engine with advanced technology. I mean, for instance, Mazda, in their new redesign of their biggest people mover, it's a 7-passenger affair, and it's being run by a 2.5-liter 4-cylinder turbocharged engine.
Mm-hmm.
And it outdoes a 6-cylinder normally aspirated engine without even trying.
Trains made that transition in the 70s and 80s where they started turbocharging all the trains. And they were basically able to have the size of the engines needed to put on the on the on the tracks.
But you know, so we don't. I mean, those weren't necessarily better engines just because they were bigger, but because but they were also engines that were hauling a lot heavier automobiles.
Yeah.
You know, I was a Chrysler kid growing up, and those things were truly lead sleds, and it takes a lot of force to get to overcome the inertia of that little sucker sitting still.
And I think the average car is more than halved the weight they were in this, even in the early 70s.
Oh yeah, oh absolutely. So
I can swear I had a 1,500-pound car, and back in the mid 60s, 4,000 was not unheard of.
Oh no no no! I don't think it was unreasonable to see it cross five. I mean, you think about the great big Cadillacs of the mid-60s to early 70s. Yeah, that was the height of the. Oh, there's a
I
movie.
I think my 71 Olds 98 was the heaviest car I had, and I think it was over five.
Yeah, they were beasts.
Yeah,
but I mean, and so you know, there's been an economic reason to make things, and they've gotten, you know, cars have gotten safer. But we haven't crossed that barrier where we realize that that now we've got to move to that place where they're safer for the rest of humanity.
And we just need to eliminate how much we need to use them. For one thing, Louisiana, how much longer can we keep replacing the places when there's floods? We've got to start thinking about. What do we actually need to be doing in Louisiana, in Mississippi, and should we be making an energy efficient place for them to live elsewhere?
And the next point that follows on that is there's a difference between how do we reduce the automobile presence in the United States, and I've mentioned this before in an urban setting. Versus how we do it out here in a rural setting, and I think you're fairly rural too.
Extremely rural. People actually, for real, actually drive horse and buggy to the grocery store.
Well, and that's the thing. I can't hitch old Dobbin to the Shea to go 6 miles up to the Wiggling Pig and 6 miles back.
Diesel electric trains. Electromotive division of General Motors has had them over 60 years now, and they're almost every train you look at. If it's not a steam train, it's diesel electric, and the newer ones for low speed in town usage, they tend to put a completely electric unit between or paired with each diesel powered unit. Because the trains that were built were kind of all built for huge loads, and many of the town loads, even the commuter loads, don't need that huge engine. So what they found is they could use instead of using two units with an extra weight of the train cab or whatever, it can cut the entire half of a second engine. Off and just put the motor tracks underneath it, a bit of weight on top of it, and let one diesel power motor run two train engines, drive two train engines.
But again, to make that a realistic possibility in rural America, of which there are still quite a lot, is a level of commitment and mobilization.
We don't even have buses between the towns out here.
Well, you know, my little rural, I mean, there's a little town about 2 miles from me. Unfortunately, the grocery store is 6 miles in the other direction. And we don't have any form of mass transit, period, zero, zip, nada. you know, old folks who need to get to the store pay a neighbor to come and drive their car, or pay them to come and take them in their car.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for people on a fixed income, that's no answer.
No.
And the mobile, the level of mobilization it would require to solve a problem like that is probably past even the level that we were engaged in the Second World War.
Yes, but I think it would be a huge economic benefit to us if we had a system where you didn't have to worry about mobility.
No, and if we designed that system, and the only thing comparable to it would be the construction of the interstate highway system. If we designed a system like that, Snork, and we're deadly in earnest about it, wouldn't we get somewhere approaching zero unemployment?
Oh, we'd have to be begging people to come here again.
And wouldn't that, well, no. See, the minute you said begging people to come here again, you just made all the Trumpanzees' hair catch fire.
Yeah.
More Mexicans! So, I mean, the thing is, I mean, you know, you quite often work, if I understand correctly, in a theoretical realm that eventually translates into, no pun intended, a concrete realm.
Yeah. I help people take theoreticals and make it real.
And some of the aspects of the problem we face, in theory, are not that complicated. Am I correct?
Right. It's an attitude problem we have to overcome. Just like many of the faults that in factories that have recalls and things are often a personality issue. When you have to search down through the base.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, golf is a very simple game. All you have to do is stand 375 yards away and put a little, you know, two inch in circumference sphere in a 4 inch in circumference hole by hitting the ball one time.
Mm-hmm.
In execution, it's a bitch. The hole in one, you know. I mean, look at how, you know, you get the idea.
Yeah.
And we face something orders of magnitude more complex than that. And so my argument is that it cannot be accomplished in the structure that we presently have at a governmental level.
Mm-hmm. And we have other issues that are going to be coming up in what we call the Pareto next, because if we actually do get our act together and start working on climate change, it means that we have to solve other issues as well. And it's not something that's going to end. We're going to need more minerals that are sinking toward the center of the Earth. We need to replenish, the current technology we use for making refrigeration is only 5% as efficient as one developed in Wisconsin that uses a material called gadolinium, but we have a limited supply of it. We have to get it from space where it's abundant. Well, if we want to start getting to space, we need to start getting a better delivery method. We need to start talking about mass drivers, and once we start using mass drivers, we have to start thinking about how many times can we launch into space before we start messing up our orbit, our daytime period, because we can't keep shooting everything the same direction in space. We change the period of our day. But right now, you'd think, the Earth weighs so much, that's never going to happen. We never thought that we would have problems with carbon dioxide when we started lighting matches.
I'm sure that the first time Og made a fire of his own, 40, 50,000, 70,000 years ago, whatever. Maybe longer. He said, "Oh, this is going to change everything." Muriel, we're cooking dinner, and he wasn't thinking about what we'd be dealing with now. But you know, the real world aspects of this stuff, Snork, are the devil that's in the details. You know, I just got a note from Carol. She says, "I live in such a rural setting, and all the jobs are 50 miles away. If you want to make anything resembling a living wage. I work 65 mm-hmm. hours a week and drive 120 miles a day just in my commute, and that doesn't count the additional 100 miles I put on the road for business. Think I don't cringe about the emissions I'm responsible for? But I have to live, Bob. I put 1,000 miles a week on my car." And that's what I meant when I was saying earlier, you know, we don't do this, you know, the us hoi polloi. We don't do this because we're just all eat up with road fever. We do it because it is a necessity that has been foisted upon us by the 0.1% of the people who own the vast amount of wealth in this country. And mm-hmm. and Thurston Barrington Gottrocks the 17th, well, he just doesn't give up because it's never gonna be real to him. There's yeah. always going to be someone there to drive the car around to pick him up. If he needs to fly somewhere, it doesn't matter what the ticket costs. And it damn sure doesn't matter if a few indigenous people in the Indian Ocean just go under in the Maldives. You know, them. He's got his. Let them figure out how to get rich
mm-hmm.
underwater.
The people in Kiribati, twice a year, they have to climb the trees. It's called king tides, where the really high tide comes in and floods everything. Nothing is several meters deep, and it comes real fast. And a lot of these people can't even afford clocks.
Jesus.
So you
don't even know when it's coming.
Don't know exactly when it's coming. That's exactly right.
And I mean, closer to home, I mean, you mentioned Louisiana. Jay Cruzan, who has reason to know about these things, has talked. His hair's on fire about climate change because he works in a place where he's already seeing it happen on an almost daily basis in South Florida. And hello, Zika virus. They're trying to figure out right now whether to designate a certain portion of Miami as a no-go zone, you know, not for Christians or white folks, but for pregnant women.
Yeah.
I have
plant physiologists telling me that we need to start making the transition to all of our farming being indoors. Because it's going to take 50 years to make that kind of transition.
How are you going to put 10,000 acres indoors? You know, one of those massive factory farms out on, out on the fruited plain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's going to be a challenge all by itself. But, you know, we are
for
not,
most crops,
but the thing is, we are not that far removed from, at least many of us, from an entirely different time.
One of the things that we've gotten far, on my, project that I was doing with California with indoor farming was that we were able to get crops that would be grown in Iowa in 4 months. We could get three seasons in, and we didn't have to do it at just one level. So 1 acre for us was the equivalent of 10 acres of farming. We also wouldn't need tractors working in the way they are. Tractors are always fighting everything. We would use more factory methods moving the product through. They don't all need a light. The plant only needs 10 hours of plant light a day. So you can accelerate the plant's life to 10 or 20 hour days. And you can you play all kinds of tricks when you plant indoors. So a lot of our crops, you'd be surprised. And once you're not tied to the sun, nobody says those plants can't be grown under where people live or work.
Or once you figured out a way to tie yourself to the sun and move its direct effects out of its direct light. Yeah. But what I meant about things that we have forgotten, just my own story. My grandfather was born in 1894. He was a coal miner because that's what was here. He died in 1968. In that span of time, he never owned an automobile and never had a driver's license. In this same small town, okay, the one where the grocery store is 6 miles away, it didn't used to be. Because as long as there was a coal community here, there was an A&P and a Kroger's. There were two movie theaters, three banks, pool halls, soda shops, hardware stores. And so there's, another, and to get to work, it's not like he went around the corner. He always just went around the corner to go to the mines. I mean, the mine was at its nearest, a good 3 miles away up the mountain. But the company had a bus. And then at one point in time, he was working in a mine called Cunard, C-U-N-A-R-D, and that sucker was 20 miles away. But again, there was a bus. My father worked at a place called Union Carbide, at a furnace that made silicon metal. He didn't drive to work every day. There was a bus. And see, the point being that when it is in the interest of capitalism, capitalism will provide the infrastructure. But as soon as all the coal played out, the grocery stores were gone, the movie theaters left, the banks shut. We still got two banks. You know, we're down to a bank, a Dollar General, and two convenience stores.
Mm-hmm.
But it's again, while the picture on the one hand is kind of grim, it is not unsolvable.
Yeah. This town used to have, it's approximately 2 miles by 2 miles, and it used to have a store about every quarter mile. A tinier store. Because almost everybody walked to the store.
Yeah. And that, the time I'm talking about is also, it's a time before there was strung decentralized electricity. My mother told me stories about the electric lights that they had in their home that they had because every now and then they went and they swapped out a drained Delco battery for a fresh Delco battery.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the battery technology of 80 years ago.
Yeah, even up until the 70s, you could go to a hardware store and buy dry cells, which were the power of a AA battery, but the, I think, 3 inches in diameter and about a foot tall. I might not be right on the dimensions because it's been so long since I've seen one, but they were huge. And people put a string of those together to run radios for a year or two.
Yeah, or electric lights. At the same time, they're cooking on wood-fired stoves or even coal-fired stoves. That was no good. They're heating with coal because that's what was around here. That transitions to fuel oil. But the am I wrong, or has the technology made giant leaps forward in especially, both efficiency and ability?
Especially in the last 15 years.
And so
you can get a Chevy Nova now. If somebody's driving 100 miles a day, I'd really recommend looking at a Chevy Nova. Or no, I got that wrong. Chevy, it's not Nova.
The Spark, the Cruise.
Yeah, Yeah, the Chevy Spark.
Or are you talking about the Volt?
The Volt. It half the time it's electric. Once you've gone past 40 miles, you go gas. But even then, it's extremely good.
Yeah, the only problem with that being, Snort, that the damn things are $35,000 base, brand new.
Yeah, there is one model that's base at 26, but the Ford has a counter to it.
The Fusion.
That's a lot less expensive and is actually more fuel efficient.
But it's pure electric only for the first 15 miles as opposed to the first 35 or 40.
Yeah, Volt, V-O-L-T.
Yeah, that's the Chevy Volt. And, I mean, I had the opportunity to ride in one a couple of years back, and I loved it. I've wanted one ever since because the technology is fascinating. And, of course, our buddy Ray down in Florida, when he and his beloved moved from Michigan to Florida, they did it in a Volt at around 90 miles a gallon. But that's the larger issue. The technology has moved forward, but we have remained so attached to our hydrocarbons that it hasn't benefited from the economy of scale, so that it could ramp up fast enough that the price would fall.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd adore to have a Chevy Volt.
Same here.
But also, by the same token, in a rural community, I've said this in the past, we'll know that the electric vehicle people are getting serious when there's an electric pickup truck.
Yes.
And I'm told that that's in the offing.
And electric school buses now.
But the electric pickup truck I find fascinating because it's not just that it'll get you to the job site, but you can, once you get there, you can also charge up your battery packs for your tools, your drills, your saws, what have you.
Not only that, but you talk about pulling power. The electric motor is going to outdo the gas.
By the way, Ray, whom I mentioned just a moment ago, and I just accidentally sent him a blank email, said used Volts are showing up under $5,000, but that's because the Volt itself, the battery, God, the last I checked, the battery replacement on a Chevy Volt is something like $15,000.
Yes.
And so if you buy a Chevy Volt with a shot battery, you just bought a $15,000 car. And that's what I mean about ramping the technology into the economies of scale. And I guess I'm now a capitalist? Holy hell. I don't know.
I would have liked to have seen us be far enough along that we would have had a battery exchange system where you drive your car, swap your battery out, and you have the battery be swappable enough that it's a 30-second change to swap your battery. And I don't think that would have been that realistic. The first electric car that came up with, before they were going to go with the battery type now, when there was, this was 30 years ago, used an aluminum electrolyte that you would pull up to the gas station and you would dump your electrolyte. And after you close the valves, a new load would come into your batteries. And you'd drive off, and you could go for 100 refuels, and then after that you'd have to swap out your plates, which meant you'd basically change out your battery. But it was, they were looking for something that would be as convenient for people as gasoline is now. But you would have a lot longer range. You have 1,000 miles between battery charges.
That's amazing, and but of course, look at the way the industry runs. And I just as an analogy, Snork, consider cell phones. So it used to be people would opt maybe for a Samsung Galaxy or some other Android device, especially because the batteries were pop off the back, take out the old one, put in a new one, right? It made it convenient, and then you charge the old one, so you've always got blah, 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 blah. Well, now, if you want a Samsung Galaxy or an iPhone, and you know, and meanwhile, the iPhone was a sealed unit, and you couldn't do a damn thing about the battery. You were just married to it. But now, the new Samsung 7 series has a sealed battery too, as does the iPhone, and so the you know that possibility of making a phone last a hell of a lot longer by swapping batteries, well, that was bad for the shareholders, wasn't it?
Well, we used to have the same problem with car parts. If we suggested a change, it'd make the part last too long. That gets shot down right away.
Yeah. So, I don't. Obviously, I don't know what the answer is. I know there are answers, but it becomes a question, and I think it's the question that resides at the core of what Bill McKibben was writing about. It's a question of national will, and of desire, and I don't see how if this is a war as he describes it. How do you win a war when a significant plurality, if not a majority, of the people think they're living in peace or are yelling, hell no, we won't go?
It's we have to stop the fighting first.
Well, yeah, and who's waging the war? Us or that 0.1%, Snort?
Looks like right now we've got to wait another two years before we get anything done. Unless we can get some presidents and vice presidents impeached.
And somewhere along the way, we need a Congress. Don't forget a Congress.
I'm watching brand new Congress very closely.
So am I, and I'm hoping to participate here on a local level. There's some organizing being done. Well, Snork, it's been a wonderful conversation. It always is, and I really appreciate the know-how and the technology and the expertise that you bring to the conversation. I genuinely do.
Thanks.
Have a great night.
Bye
now. You know what's cool? I get to talk to a lot of smart people from all over the world. I can't imagine what it must be for somebody like the oxymoron Rush Limbaugh. I mean, there's a reason he never opens the lines, because the only people who are going to call him are fucking idiots. Not here. No, not here. Quick reminder, we try to raise $200 every evening. And we are at this point in time, with 45 minutes to go in the program, we're at zero. And remember, the wild rice premium is on the table. A $60 contribution will get you a pound. $100 will get you two. Okay. So let's go back to the phones and check in with Scott and Punky. What's happening, Scott?
Hey, Bob. Everything is tickety-boo here in San Diego.
Just another shitty day in paradise, yes.
No, it's a lovely day in paradise. The heat seems to be subsiding, which is nice, because I don't have AC. But normally that's not a problem, but every now and then it gets to be one, but, you know, it's the weather, it changes. I've got two things to pass along, to converse about, and they'll be kind of quick things, or maybe slow things. One of them is, when you were talking about McKibben's piece about the war, declaring war on climate change, I got to thinking about one of the highlights of summer in the 60s when I was a youngster growing up on the outskirts of D.C. My paternal grandmother lived right next door, and in her garage was a 1922 Dodge sedan that my dad's family used for many, many years, back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And the highlight of summer each year as a kid would be when my two uncles from Miami would come up to Virginia, where we lived. And they were, at the time, airline mechanics for United and Eastern, based in Miami. And they, along with my dad and with another of their brothers, would push the 1922 Dodge out of the garage into the driveway and commence to work upon it mechanically to get it to the point where it would start up. And we'd take it once around the block, literally, below the Ooga horn, with the kids all piled in the back seat and standing on the running board. And it was just, it's one of my fondest childhood memories. Well, this 1922 Dodge, the last valid license plates it had on it were Virginia plates issued in 1947. Okay? And on the windshield of said 22 Dodge was a sticker emblazoned with the letter A. And I remember asking my dad, what is that sticker? And it turns out it was the most commonly issued gas rationing sticker during World War II. And it would entitle the bearer of the sticker to buy, I think it was like 4 or 5 gallons of gas a week, because it being wartime against Germany and Japan and Italy, Americans actually did their part to conserve and to put forth a little bit of sacrifice to support the war effort overseas.
Well, the vast majority of Americans did, but remember, I'm sure that with gasoline, just as it was with beef in Pittsburgh, there was the libertarian hero class that said, "I don't care what the troops need, I want me some damn gas."
Oh yeah, and there were a lot of people. I mean, they had food ration coupons, and there were a lot of black marketeers and people who would skirt the system because their attitude was, "I don't want to, and you can't make me." It was a typical two-year-old's attitude, basically. You know, fuck patriotism. I'm an American. Damn it, I got my rights. But anyway, so I thought back to that, and even with today's automotive technology, I doubt that most Americans could do well on 5 gallons of gas a week, given, who was it, Carol said that she drives round trip 40 miles, 100 miles?
Oh, no. She does 1,000 miles a week.
Oh, Jesus, no, there's no way. I mean, unless you had a hybrid car, and even then, I don't think 5 gallons of gas would suffice.
No, 5 gallons of gas in a Prius would get you something like 200 miles.
Yeah, so she's screwed even before she leaves the driveway.
Right, but see, in the other example, the bus that ran up and down the mountain to that Union Carbide plant, they had an economic reason for having it. Their workers didn't have cars, and they damned well needed the workers. So thus, look, they solved the transportation problem.
Yeah, but for only as long as it was a need that served their interests, they being the coal companies.
Well, in this case, Union Carbide.
Yeah.
But you know, that was an 80-mile round trip. And the bus ran all the way out to, probably about 10 miles east of where I am here. Just like a school bus. And actually 3 times a day. Because, you know, it was a 24-hour shift circuit.
Yeah. Well, also thinking about, you know, the A sticker on my grandmother's 1922 Dodge, and thinking about McKibben's piece, I got to thinking also about something I saw, I believe, on 60 Minutes about 6 or 8 years ago. And I think it was a company out in California, somewhere on the West Coast, who had come up with a little gizmo about 3 or 4 feet cube sized that would go outside of a dwelling, and it worked on the principle of a fuel cell that basically ran on hydrogen, which you could get from water, and it had a byproduct of water, but basically it would generate the electricity. Something that small would generate the electricity for a house, a good-sized house, as I recall. And there was some company that they had a pilot program where they installed a large number of these things adjacent to a big box store sort of building, and ran the place, got their electricity from whatever this gizmo was that operated as basically a string of fuel cells. That to me would be, if you were to mandate or legislate that all new dwellings would be required to have this kind of device, would be helpful. And even dwellings that are, say, 8 or 10 years old, existing dwellings, be retrofitted for it. That seems to me to be a step in the right direction.
But you're talking about a mandate, Scott, and that's fine. I think that would be that's a step forward. But you're pushing against the inertia of one, cost, and two, of people just to live the way they've been living, because it upsets the apple cart to have to, you know, because you know, solar panel installation is not DIY yet.
No, it's not.
Not on the scale that would run a home. And it's also, I think it's fair to describe it as prohibitively expensive. It's not, and I've learned a little bit about this because I researched it pretty thoroughly. It's not prohibitively expensive in places that value it. One. It's not prohibitively expensive as long as it's still tied to a centralized grid. But to go all the way off the damn grid and run it, you know, solar power with a bank of batteries, it is brutally expensive, A, and B, and this says more about our culture, in some places, it's a crime.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, and when you speak of resistance on the part of anybody mandating anything to people who are two-year-olds and say, I don't want to, and you can't make me, a way to present it to them, if they were willing to really look at it, was, what are the stakes otherwise? Doing something is generally better than doing nothing. And if they were in any way convinced of the magnitude of the situation that we face on a global scale or a national scale, if they're patriots and don't give a shit about anybody else on the planet, would be, yeah, you may be inconvenienced in the short run, but in the long run, you'll still be here to bitch about it.
Well, we get speechifying on climate change from the Democratic side. The Republican side just simply refuses to acknowledge that it even exists. They refuse to acknowledge it exists. They openly deny it. Okay.
Oh yeah, they think it's a scam.
And they've got 40% at least of the electorate locked down tight, even with their current nominee. All right?
I know.
So, but even when Democrats talk about it, they talk about it in the most tepid of terms. You know, the way to talk about climate change and sustainable renewable energy is to talk about a massive federal Marshall program for our own country that solarizes every home, every apartment building, every dwelling in the United States.
kind of like what Jimmy Carter was talking about in 79 during the so-called malaise speech. I sent you the link.
Yeah, may the for-profit media be eternally damned for hanging that term on the speech.
Yeah.
The word malaise does not appear anywhere in the text.
Oh, I know. It was a catchphrase or a catchword that they came up to dismiss it. But what Carter was saying, and if you read the speech today, 30-some years later, he raises some good points, although some of the solutions that he put forward in that speech, like using coal as a bridge energy, we know now that coal just adds to the problem. So you'd have to revise some of the solutions.
Well, and natural gas as a bridge fuel.
Yeah, but his point was, you know, we don't have an energy crisis. We have a confidence crisis. We are poor mouthing ourselves as a nation. And God knows that was true then. Look how it is now. We're poor mouthing ourselves to the point of being so dispirited and despondent that, it seems almost impossible that anything could be done at this point, although I'm a where's the pony kind of kid. You know, I see the room full of pony residue, so I insist that the presence of a pony is somewhere in that pile, because there's evidence that a pony has been here. Okay, so there's probably some workaround, but it's, you know, it may require mass lobotomies on the part of the detractors, but, you know, hey, you do what you got to do. I say that jokingly, of course. Some of them, it would be redundant to do a lobotomy. So, but I'm just thinking, you know, I sent you a thing about hemp seed oil. Here's something that grows. You don't have to mine it. You don't have to do anything other than plant the seeds. Hell, throw the seeds. They used to put these marijuana seeds in canary food to make the birds sing, and in wild bird food, and the birds would, through like your little civet friends, would eliminate the seeds, and that's why you would find pot and hemp growing hither and yon all over the landscape. And I think we're a better country back then.
But, well, from an Appalachian standpoint, Scott, you might be interested to know, I read an article earlier today that Beyond Coal, you know, and it was in the New York Times, and one of the projects that it references is a couple of guys in Kentucky who got permits for a hemp pilot farm, because there are like six states that have been cleared by the federal government for industrial hemp.
Mm-hmm.
And the article notes that hemp was first grown in cultivated in Kentucky in 1775. So lo and behold, they're taking this industrial hemp, and of course it's a guy with a Yale MBA, but he comes from Kentucky. They're growing hemp on six sites in four counties, and 5 acres of their hemp farming is taking place on a reclaimed mountaintop removal strip job.
There you go.
And industrial hemp may be one of the only things, the only thing perhaps, that can actually thrive on such a miserable plot. Because the hemp plant will damn near grow on concrete.
And you look at some of the uses of hemp seed oil and the hemp fiber. I mean, you've got lubrication, you've got biodiesel to run things, you've got fiber. I think I read something once about using it to make building materials, for crying out loud.
Well, biodiesel is not nearly as promising as was once thought, simply because the particulate emissions, it doesn't matter if it's hydrocarbon-based or hemp oil-based or rapeseed oil-based or corn oil-based, a diesel engine still puts out particulate matter that is extremely dangerous to human well-being.
But it's the thought process, I guess, is what I'm getting at. The fact that we paint ourselves into these corners, and then even though the paint has dried and you can safely walk upon the surface that's been painted, we still have a mindset that we're in this trouble to those who feel that we are actually in trouble, and we refuse to see that there's any way out of it. And I'm saying that there are ways. You've just got to be creative and open-minded and honest enough to avail yourselves of them. There's way too much diarrhea of the mouth and way too much constipation of the brain. And you look at the Mar-a-Lago Mussolini, and that's Exhibit A in the great courtroom of life.
Well, I found this New York Times article quite fascinating, Scott. Folks might want to look it up again. The title of it is Beyond Coal, Imagining Appalachia's Future, and it was published yesterday. But way down in the article, there's a beautiful, no, it's not beautiful, it's an ugly example of how not to do things. So here are all these stories of people trying to have a just transition away from the failed and over, largely, coal industry of eastern Kentucky, right? And there's hemp farming, and there's people trying to teach unemployed coal miners how to write code, all kinds of stuff. So an organization was formed called SOAR, S-O-A-R, okay? And SOAR stands for Shaping Our Appalachian Region, and it was co-founded by Democratic Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear at the time, and a nasty old right-wing Republican piece of crap named Hal Rogers. And so this past June, the SOAR program held its third innovation summit. And the New York Times reports it looked like a convention of tree huggers and suits. Lunch was served outside while a bluegrass band played. There were two sandwich options, pulled pork and vegan wraps. Well, lo and behold, with people talking about coming up with different visions for how to lift eastern Kentucky out of the hellscape that capitalism and the coal industry shoved it into, along comes Hal Rogers and uses that meeting to announce a $444 million prison for eastern Kentucky. And Hal Rogers proudly stood up there and said, "And it'll bring 300 jobs." But to their credit, the people who were trying to build a new economy were furious. It made them it blood in their eyes, because that's not the answer. You know, profiting having a decimated region profit by the misery of others by building a prison that at least according that we probably don't even need. And probably won't even work. You know, they tried to build one on a mountaintop removal site 10 so years ago. Damn doors wouldn't shut because the ground wouldn't settle. They called it Sink Sink. but that's the kind of problem we face. You know, I'm biased in this regard, and I freely admit it. I think the hardest hit areas of the country deserve the most concerted efforts to rebuild and renew. I talk a lot about mountaintop removal, and they are hellscapes, and they are ugly. But there are parts of Appalachia that are breathtaking in their beauty. And that, if they don't get poisoned, actually are a starting place for a new vision of the future. You know, the Appalachia was literally the cradle of climate change in the United States. It's what fueled
all this climate change, from all the coal that was ripped out of here. Why shouldn't Appalachia be the place where we start again with a new kind of energy generation? You know, solar, wind, that kind of thing. Why shouldn't a test? Why shouldn't a pilot project for massive retrofitting of homes with solar panels and community wind? Why shouldn't that take place in Appalachia? Because you know what? If it'll work here, it'll work anywhere. Because you'll not just have to overcome physical or geographic challenges. You'll also have to overcome mindsets that say things like, coal keeps lights on. About all I know is mining coal. And if you can overcome that mindset, you can do anything anywhere else.
And that's a wondrous plan. And you ask, you know, what would keep us from doing it? Well, A, it's that mindset, but it's also something deeper. It's the vested interest of people who have enriched themselves, who have gorged themselves on the multiple billions of dollars in profit over the years of keeping things exactly as they are. And once upon a time, coal made perfect sense. But in today's world and tomorrow's world, if we get to keep it, it doesn't make any sense at all. And that's the task, is to present that in a way that people will get it, like you would get a joke. You don't have to explain a joke. It'll hit you, and you'll laugh, or you'll see the irony or the humor. Okay? And there's the big task, is to cause a shift of awareness and consciousness and attitude in people to say, damn it, you know, those folks are right. And we're only doing it to ourselves, or letting it be done to us. Enough is enough. Let's do something new. And that's going to be the springboard. But, you know, looking at the situation as it currently is, you don't see many glimmers of hope or opportunity because of the entrenched nature of the mindset, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I feel for people who are stuck in various places in this country, who, it's that old thing, been down so long, it looks like up to me. Well, in a literal sense, it is up to them to educate themselves and to find out and to then bring some accountability to the process and vote those scoundrels out and not replace them with new and improved scoundrels. And that, again, is a process, and it takes more than one or two or three election cycles.
And we're running, and that's the thing, in the face of this crisis, Scott, we're running out of election cycles.
Oh, Jesus, the clock is so close to ticking down to zero. When you look at the malaise speech, so-called, of 1979, 30-some-odd years ago, that's when things should have begun to happen in terms of shifting. We would have given ourselves an incredible head start and more than half a chance had people said, damn it, President Carter's absolutely right. Now let's be about behaving in a manner consistent with changing stuff.
But so, instead, yeah. The American people wanted to hear a greasy-headed old B-movie actor say that there was no problem and that it was morning in America and we're a shining city on the hill, and bullshit.
Yeah, and what was one of the first things he did upon moving into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue? He took down the damned
solar panels.
Yeah, on top of the White House.
Yeah, I mean, the two of the very first things Ronald Reagan did was to order those solar panels torn down, because they were an affront even to the sight of his owners in the hydrocarbon industry, the oil industry, the coal, gas, whatever. Yeah. And the other thing was to tax the tips of waitresses and waiters. Great guy.
Yeah.
Hot enough for you down there, Ron?
Well, you know, just to undo the damage that he did on many, many levels, we've still got our work cut out for us there, in addition to keeping the planet from going up like a fricasseed chicken on a spit.
Punky hates it when you talk like that.
Well, that's why I put him in the other room before I made the call, because I know how he gets.
Well, I mean, you would too.
Of course. Of course. But anyway, that's my bit for today, and I'm going to look up that article because I think I saw it, but just didn't get around to
well, it's at newrepublic.com, and I suspect it'll probably appear somewhere around the front page.
And also the New York Times piece about what's going on in West Virginia with hemp and stuff, because I had heard something vaguely a year or so ago that some states are finally saying do you know the history of how hemp got to be prohibited?
Yes.
You want to go over that? Part of it had to do with the pulp wood newsprint empire.
And the other part of it has to do with the oil industry.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, vested interests rearing their ugly, greedy heads, keeping... Hell, I think our founding documents were written on hemp paper, if I'm not mistaken.
No, that's parchment.
Okay, well, I know Washington grew hemp at Mount Vernon.
Oh, God. Hemp was cultivated all over the early United States because there was a massive market for it. Because the Navy needed it. Lots of it.
For rope, fiber, yeah.
Yeah. It was a beneficial plant. And, of course, there were, you know, all that hemp being grown. Guess who actually grew it? Yeah, old Mars didn't grow it. Old Mars didn't cultivate it. Old Mars didn't chop it. Old Mars didn't process it. Uh-uh. He just profited by it.
Mm-hmm. And see, when I talk about a shift in a mindset, it's not necessarily all about learning new stuff. It's about rediscovering stuff that we already knew at one point. That shouldn't be too hard. It is, but it shouldn't be, you know.
But it's not the difficulty, Scott, that factors in. Difficulty is... A degree of difficulty is not one of those things that you get judged on there, you know, in the floor exercise. It's a matter of getting past the people who want to prevent it from happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's like overcoming the inertia of that 5,000-pound automobile Snork was talking about. We have to get over the inertia that comes from having a Republican Congress. And that inertia, in turn, is generated by the inertia of the Confederate states.
Well, in terms of a solution, it wouldn't hurt to have a president along the lines of Roosevelt, Franklin D., or even LBJ in terms of, you know, say what you will about Vietnam, but that guy... brought into being a lot of stuff that the Democrats had wanted for 20 years or more. I remember Medicare was one of them, and that's something that millions of us benefit from to this day.
And that even right-wingers don't want to see go away.
No.
Hence the teabaggers in their scooters outside the Supreme Court saying, keep your government hands off my Medicare.
Exactly.
The Obamacare debate.
But I was watching a PBS thing the other night about LBJ, and I've come to rethink him. I mean, I was just a teenager, you know, when he was escalating in Vietnam and denying the fact that we could, or promoting the fact that we could, the theory that we could actually win that civil war over there. And I had a falling out with him, but in looking back on some of the really amazingly great things that he did, And then you look at today's choices. Who do you have? You have the demented circus peanut. You got Hillary.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You said the magic word. The devil!
And then for those...
Got to keep the greenies happy.
And then you've got, you know, in two marginal columns, you've got Gary Johnson as the libertarian, and you've got
marginal. Dr. Man, you said a mouthful.
Yeah, I chose that word carefully. And then you've got Dr. Jill Stein.
See, you went for marginal. I would have gone for statistically irrelevant.
Well, I always try to keep my sunny side up, you know, because even false hope is better than no hope at all, you know. But that's just me. I mean, I've got to do what I've got to do in November, and I will take no joy in it, except for the fact that it could very well keep us from having the Mar-a-Lago Mussolini in charge.
And that's the thing. I it is seldom that one can consider one's presence in a majority Republican jurisdiction to be a blessing or a luxury. But I am. Those luxuries are fast disappearing. They're disappearing in South Carolina. They're disappearing in Georgia. But for me, I can still sit here and say, you know, I'm not going to vote for Trump, but I don't have to vote for her. And I damn sure won't vote for Jill Stein or Gary Johnson. I'll just leave it blank. And you know, for Hillary, I'm waiting on the proud announcement that she's been endorsed by Henry Kissinger, and that's when that slot goes left blank. Because it doesn't matter, at least not here. You there, Scott?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm just thinking, what would the resume process be should worse come to worse and Trump gets elected? Who would I have to send a resume to get into the coal industry? Because at that point, if that bastard's in charge, we may as well promote, you know, the end of the planet as quickly as possible just to put ourselves out of the misery, you know? Can I get me one of them helmets with a light on it?
you might be aged out on the whole coal mining thing, and there's not a lot of people being hired, but you're more than welcome to come here and be poor with the rest of us. You know, all we got in common is our misery. The least we can do is share it.
Well, I would cut quite the figure, decked out in my sweet ore overalls, my miner's helmet with the lamp on top, and a big old shovel. I'd fit right in.
Yeah, but Perky, the Punky ain't gonna. The Punky is not gonna agree to play the role of canary in said coal mine. It is beneath him on a number of levels.
Hey, but bird seed ain't cheap. We've all got to do our bit.
Yeah, bird got to work.
That's right. Well, I spray end dust on the cat and chase her under stuff, you know, because cat food ain't free. So, anyway.
Oh, I'll get hate mail for that one.
Nah, everybody knows I'm kidding about that. I love my kitty and I love my bird.
And the fact that they get along, you know.
Oh, they do. They do.
You've never caught the cat hiccuping so much as a pin feather.
Not even so much as that. And it's weird because the other cat that I had for 20 years, most of Punky's life, she would lay on the bed. And Punky, who is on top of his house most of the time in the daytime, would fly over and visit with her on the bed. And I have caught him. As a matter of fact, a couple of weeks ago, I had to run some errands, and I had forgotten something. And I came back, and in the 2 minutes it took to realize I had to come back for whatever I'd forgotten, Punky had gone from the top of the cage over to the bed where the new cat was sleeping. And I said, "You brave little bastard. Your sister loves you, at least so far. She's shown no sign of wanting you for a snack." But I put him back in his house and kind of shook my finger at him, and hopefully he's faster wing-wise than she is spring-wise, because I would not like to come home to that. But I've had her a year now, and I think she understands that Punky is a member of the family and not an item on the menu.
Yeah, not that's not a snack on the wing.
Exactly, literally.
No. Literally now means figuratively. We've already got enough confusion about that. Scott, you have yourself a good evening, my friend.
You too, Bob. Take care.
And good night to Punky.
Good night, Punky.
See ya. Couple of great conversations this evening after I got done filibobstering. By far the better part of the program, in my opinion. Note coming in from Steve, a member of the Fraternity of Steve. There's no practical way, subject line, by the way, too little, way too late. There's no practical way I can see to reverse engineer the patterns of daily life and work in the post-industrial American economy. What we are living through now is the aftermath of an industrialization process born in the artificial prosperity of a post-World War II diaspora of transportation, war production, communities, lifestyles, and free market choices. Fundamentally, almost every advantage we enjoy today in how we are living is a result of less autonomy and determination in the way we should best be living. Industrial capitalism, and now its obvious failures, is only the latest chapter in a process that's been out of control from the very start. Our economy really is based on the concept of the end of the world. Doesn't that make any sort of sense anymore? It's always made sense to me. From the first time I understood the intimacy between nuclear power and the American way of life, we are quite necessarily expected to see the fulfillment of such a dead world. We talk as though we are actually not insane about the same nuclear deterrence, the same freedom, the same community of interests and desires. These are not our interests. We are not living for the needs of the present generation, but are paying dearly for what three generations have taken away or made impossible. If you're a member of the middle class, you are paying for the excesses and deprivations of those far more wasteful and negligent than you. You are paying for the depleted resources, the destroyed environment, the out-and-out criminal actions of a wealth class that need not curb its many appetites or so much as consider the alternatives. It is that class constructs the machinery of the end of the world. How can you and nobody change that? It is not history as they see it. It is destiny. Something like 60 years of fantasy life has brought the American situation to such a complete and indescribable horror. It is only more obvious in many developing economies like China, where hundreds of millions of people are suddenly convinced they can create a thriving middle-class lifestyle in the face of a growing disaster of global proportions. And they're not to blame, as are we, victims as they are of a xenophobic autocracy of fools and madmen. Whatever it is we feel it is necessary to do at this juncture, the solution, I fear, is already lost in the innocent daydreams of a dead past. I'm a spectator now, I think, waiting for the whole thing to gather steam and fury. Regards, Steve, in China. That is some profound and beautiful writing, and that's the difficulty one runs across. Perhaps it only rises out of the ashes, but getting to those ashes is going to be one hell of a fire. Meanwhile, from another member of the Fraternity of Steve, I was listening to the program yesterday on the podcast. I only was able to catch some of it live. I was listening to the part about Brian Fisher and his crap about Hillary and Velveeta King that I did hear live and her crap about Hillary. I'm no fan of Hillary Clinton. However, the vitriol that she has had to undergo over the last 25 years is nothing short of sickening. These people like Velveeta King don't think about their words at all. I don't mean from a violent or incitement perspective. I mean from a human perspective. They don't think of the impact those words might have had on a loved one of their target. Yes, I use that word intentionally. Can you imagine the impact that those words have on Chelsea or Bill? These people seem to have no insight to think about what impact these words might have on the loved ones of Hillary. Can you imagine how your kids would feel about hearing a person, and not just an anonymous person, but the nominee of the other major presidential party and other president public figures like Limbaugh, Fisher, King, and others, putting out over the airwaves or in print the vitriol against you that these people put out against Hillary? They never think of this. They seem to be incapable of it. I'll add editorially, Steve, it's because they have no conscience. You mentioned Bill, you mentioned Chelsea. I think about the little Mesvitsky grandkids. They know that she's Grammy and she's important. It doesn't enter into their little minds that she's the devil. But they'll learn. They'll learn. Steve continues, I was listening to the podcast on the subway, and Bob, I almost threw up and started crying at the same time. The hatred is palpable. I would go so far as to say it has flavor and substance. I almost had to shut it off. Then to listen to Brian Fisher spew his utter hatred and vitriol about Hillary's motivation to be the Antichrist, for which for him as a Christian is the worst thing he can say about someone. Say what you want about Hillary, she's not so bad that she would warrant the worst thing that a Christian can say about someone. These are things reserved for the likes of Hitler, Mao, Stalin, and yes, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, and Wolfowitz. I have a hard time including Bush here because I think he was nothing but a useful idiot. But again, listening to Brian Fisher made me say that I don't want to identify myself as a Christian. I just don't want to be identified with those people. On the other hand, it also strikes me that in doing so, I let his ilk define what that means. In the same way, I could say I don't want to identify as an American because I don't want to be identified with the likes of Cheney et al. But likewise, if I do that, they win. They get to decide what that means. It seems to me that the best way to combat them is confrontation. I'm a Christian. I'm a believer. I make no bones about it. I look at Brian Fisher and would rather challenge him on his Christianity. The core of Christian teaching starts from the Beatitudes and works from there. The core of Christian teaching starts from the way Jesus admonished his followers to treat the poor, the hungry, the naked, the outcast. As you well know, one of the Beatitudes says, "Blessed are the peacemakers." While I'm not sure that I agree that it is up to me to say whether or not Brian Fisher is a Christian, it is up to me to challenge him and confront him and admonish him and scold him by saying that in no way, under no circumstances, could his words or Velveeta King's words be considered acting as a peacemaker. In addition, it is incumbent upon me to speak up and give why I think that's inconsistent with Jesus' teaching. So if Brian Fisher or anyone who knows him is listening, I'm throwing down the gauntlet. I challenge him or anyone with his view to debate and discuss any time and anywhere. Why am I doing this? Well, I don't want to be self-righteous. However, I take that blessed are the peacemakers seriously. I take feed the hungry seriously. I take the love of my neighbors as myself seriously. I don't do these all the time. I don't do these nearly enough, but what I don't do is condemn anyone as having the Antichrist as their motivation. Why? I wouldn't want my family hearing something like that about me, and I won't do that to them. Steve. And with those two eloquent missives, we'll close off. Thanks, everybody. Thanks so very much. Friday on the front porch tomorrow. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.